queso and the tacos. Unless I'd begged for an assisted suicide, no one I know in real life would ever propose to me an hour of horrified weight checks and guilt-ridden calorie tabulation disguised as social activity. Is this because I got bacon on my burger the other night? I demanded of the sleek, hardened profile, its darkness standing out in sharp relief against the blazing sunshine outside the car window. Of course not, he lied unconvincingly. Mm-hmm. I saw you give the waiter a look when I asked him if the restaurant had a set of defibrillator paddles. Sam, there were three different proteins on your plate. Aha, there it was. Bacon shame. From someone with a preternaturally high metabolism who looked very good in the inappropriately tight turtlenecks he was fond of wearing. I should have never given my number to a man I'd watched writing his name on the clipboard for open mic at a poetry reading, but I was momentarily dazzled by the perfectly aligned piano key teeth revealed when he smiled and pointed at the book I was reading, The Devil Finds Work, and proclaimed it his favorite Baldwin. I should have rolled my eyes and told him to keep it moving because that's no one's favorite Baldwin, but this is the beauty of being beautiful. People just let your dumb shit rock. So, ignoring the inner voice screaming at the sight of his scribbled-in notebook full of deep and meaningful future song lyrics, I heaved my backpack off the seat next to me and let this walking stereotype talk to me about Fela Kuti. How many points are in an entire pizza? I stage whispered to Jay halfway through the meeting. All 1,287 chins in the room turned to glare at me. You know, what happens if I just can't stop and I eat the whole thing? Do I just add up 12 pizza slice points and not eat for 3 weeks? That is a real question, okay? If you can have one square of triple thin crust pizza and happily close the top of the box and put it in your refrigerator until the next day and not wake up periodically throughout the night asking yourself whether or not you made a huge mistake, then maybe this is not the book for you. Bitches gotta eat. Jay was hoping that the riveting world of calorie counting and cheat meals would spark a desire to get with his version of healthy so that we could, in his words, be a better match. And I kept a notebook so full of formulas and calculations that it looked like Good Will Hunting wrote that shit. I was crabby and terrible and went to sleep dreaming about pudding every night, but I lost 10 pounds. Jay was happy. I was hungry. All was right in the world. Until I asked him if he was ever going to not have 3 roommates and maybe get a checking account. You know, so we could be a better match. Then it was over. I know a lot of hot, unconventionally beautiful ladies who kick ass and have sex with rock star dudes and aren't sorry about it at all. I need to say this loud for the girls in the back of the class. If a dude doesn't want to have to use both hands to grab your ass, that's totally cool. It's his choice. But that doesn't make you a piece of shit. You hoist up your saddlebags and go find some dude who thinks you're rad and doesn't mind wiping the sweat off your bottom stomach when you switch sex positions. Don't be all down in the dumps like a truck, and let opportunists and perverts take advantage of some low self-esteem you are absolutely too awesome to have. When I couldn't catch a goddamn cold for 2+ years after Fred and I broke up, I did not give a shit because I vowed to stop fucking around with people who hate me or don't laugh at my jokes or want me to be thankful for the opportunity to split a lunch check on a Tuesday with a man who was in one motherfucking Old Navy shorts ad in the summer of 2009. He was sexy and everything, but, I mean, he didn't even know how to CC an email to multiple recipients. I don't have to be grateful for shit. A Christmas Carol. My freshman year of college, I accidentally became best friends with a couple of grade A douchebags. I didn't even want to go to college. but I couldn't fix cars, and I couldn't do hair, and I hadn't had a baby sophomore year, so an accredited university was the next best choice. What I really wanted to do was pull a blanket over my head and listen to Pearl Jam's No Code on repeat while eating snacks and pretending to be searching for myself all day. Fuck, that's all I want to fucking do now. But I couldn't find anyone willing to pay for that shit. The state, however, was offering me $15,000 to sleep through English 102 and watch The Young and the Restless. How could I refuse? The bro was called Adam, and his bra went by John, and it was my first experience with the species inside its natural habitat, a medium-sized state school with a flexible GPA admissions requirement. I ran into them, literally, while getting off the elevator on the sticky-hot freshman move-in day. Adam reached for my large cardboard box full of grunge CDs and an economy-sized bottle of Head & Shoulders, while John grabbed the small television tucked under my arm, and they marveled at my minimalist approach to dormitory life. "You don't know any poor people?" I asked as I struggled to keep up, the backpack stuffed with my two good pairs of jeans and a handful of T-shirts shifting uncomfortably across my spine. "They were seniors," John told me over his shoulder as we pushed past the crying parents and exasperated teenagers dotting the hallway, and had been roommates for all 3 years prior. He was inordinately proud of their novelty disco ball and fridge full of brews, and promised to show me their room later. Adam, though Jewish, was from the north side of Chicago and considered himself a homie, as was evidenced by his low-slung baggy jeans and the insertion of out-of-context Snoop Dogg lyrics into almost every conversation. "I hate the fucking word wigger more than I hate anything else on earth, but if I'm being totally honest, that's exactly what this dude was, even though it grosses me out to say so." He had large, sleepy brown eyes and a slow smile, and was the kind of guy who hit on black girls by demonstrating his encyclopedic knowledge of Luster's Pink Oil Hair Lotion and BET primetime programming. John was your typical West Suburban chest-thumping meatbag, with a body built for date rape and a giant shellacked auburn head that remained defiantly empty, save for a handful of professional baseball statistics and whatever Greek letters you need to learn to pledge the fraternity with the most lenient academic prerequisite. John was the kind of dude who already looked like someone's dad. You know what I mean? Like, the kind of dude in mirrored shades who chews bubblegum really hard with his arms crossed over his chest. The kind of perpetually tan, leathery skin motherfucker who always looks like he's standing on a sideline somewhere. The kind of asshole you are continually surprised to find without a whistle around his neck. A gentleman who should be shouting red-faced into a Bluetooth, or standing on a deck he proudly built flipping burgers on a grill he got on sale at Lowe's. They weren't bad dudes, though John's slick back hair and unironic gold chains sometimes made me want to punch him in the dick. I kind of felt bad that these dinosaurs were still working on BAs in communications and eating cafeteria lunch with 18-year-olds despite their visibly graying beards. Over time, the three of us became friends because, in exchange for my discounted tuition, I had to post up at the overnight desk in the lobby of our dorm as part of my work-study package, checking IDs while trying not to fall asleep or get vomited on. It was not glamorous work, and I was not very good at it. Mostly my job was blocking drunk dudes from entering a dorm they didn't live in and keeping the Papa John's guy company as he waited for girls in top knots and printed pajama bottoms to come down and collect their cheese-only pizzas. John and Adam loved what little nightlife DeKalb, Illinois had to offer, and after several nights of staggering in at 2 a.m., totally shithoused and with no identification, they started to recognize me on our floor and would call out, "Hey, Amanda," every time I walked past their open door with a giant bag of Doritos on my way to watch Jerry Springer in the communal lounge, because I would risk the tenuous grasp I had on that job to give them a pass. I was having a hard time finding my groove. I had a handful of friends to eat dinner and go to the movies with, But I grew up with nice kids in a nice town that had a nice school with a college and career center filled to overflowing with brochures from idyllic liberal arts college campuses across the country. I was dumb enough to be hopeful that something nice would finally happen for me. The earlier part of my lackluster senior year had been filled with daydreams of escape and reinvention. My cool New York feminist Sarah Lawrence self, or my crunchy artsy Bennington self, or my sexually free Oberlin self. I could see the sprawling lawns and smell the libraries full of old books. I had pored over all of the hip college guides, the ones that skipped all the percentages and statistics in favor of real talk about what kind of jeans to wear to class and the best local bars at which to test out your fake ID. I wrote thoughtful, honest essays trying to explain how a person with a 1520 on the SAT was also the same person who never took physics, or trig for that matter, and hadn't bothered with any AP courses and had just barely held on to a 3.2 GPA because they let me take Spanish and choir for honors credit. I went through my sweaters and boots looking for ones that might work in New England in the fall. I filled page after page with my handwritten good intentions, exchanged my saved babysitting cash for money orders to have those applications processed, then enclosed them in fat, creamy envelopes and sent them off just before the deadline to lovely-sounding places like Williamstown and Northfield and Gambier and Claremont. Months later, as names like Stanford and Wesleyan and Princeton bounced excitedly off the walls of the student center, I was coming home every afternoon to skinny rejection letters mixed in with my sister's subscriptions to Essence and Cooking Light. My counselor skimmed my list of colleges over her reading glasses while I thumbed through one of the many astrology books lining her shelves. She reassured me that there were colleges out there that would look past the C-minus in Latin American history and into the core of who I really was as a sensitive, creative air sign. But she suggested I probably should add a couple of safety schools to my list so that I definitely had somewhere to enroll come the following autumn. This is the problem with neither applying oneself nor working up to one's potential. These moments when you are reduced to a bunch of abstract letters and numbers whose unflattering reflection cannot be charmed or joked aside. On paper, I am an asshole. A National Merit Scholar who barely passed chemistry and had to take 3 different gym classes senior year because I failed one freshman year and dropped out of the summer school makeup class. 3 summers in a row. I led an insurrection of my classmates and refused to read The Grapes of Wrath, for which I should have been expelled. The schools I daydreamed about going to, you know, the ones with the lawns and the sweaters, they were looking for girls who got A's and volunteered at homeless shelters after school. I got mostly B's and a lot of C's and spent my afternoons watching Ricky Lake and sleeping until dinner. My acceptance letter from Northern Illinois University, NIU, received 2 weeks before graduation, basically read, "Our condolences, here's where you pick up your books." "What's my name, fool?" Adam said, letting himself into my room without knocking. Because I had let that dummy cheat off my biology final, he'd offered to drive me back to Evanston for the 2-week winter break, where I was going to grudgingly listen to people I passive-aggressively hated whining about how oppressive their course loads were at Harvard and pretending I hadn't just taken a 300-level math class at Northern in which the professor had used rhymes to teach trig. My roommate, Kara, had already gone home for the holidays, and Adam made himself comfortable on her bed, his long legs dangling off the extra-long twin mattress as they'd done dozens of times before. We'd spent many nights just like this, in beds opposite each other as we shoveled Chinese food into our mouths from cardboard containers and watched trash TV or listened to records with a bag of greasy Taco Bell. College was surprisingly lonely. It turns out that I am not very good at making friends unless I am already trapped in an insufferable hellscape with someone who doesn't mind my cracking a few inappropriate jokes as we circle life's drain. I kept being introduced to people who didn't know any black people, or, more often than not, any black people like me, which they exclaimed while taking me in with eyes widened to the size of dinner plates, as if I'd just hopped off a motherfucking spaceship with my cheesy blacklight posters and newfound interest in sexual experimentation. I found myself surrounded on all sides by the kind of dudes who wore shorts in the winter and blasted Tim McGraw while tucking in their polo shirts and putting on belts to go party on a Saturday night. And, surprise, surprise, I kind of liked these jagoffs. I liked watching wrestling and would never mind going in on the delicious party sampler to eat in front of Monday Night Football. Hot wings, onion rings, egg rolls, pizza bites, corn dogs, jumbo mozzarella sticks, heart disease. I'm not a just one of the guys kind of person. I fucking hate men, but I love eating and marathon television watching, and I never met any girls in DeKalb willing to endure 6 hours on a busted couch with cold cheese fries and reruns of Mystery Science Theater 3000. John could eat 17 ground beef tacos in one sitting and once watched From Dusk Till Dawn 3 consecutive times on a Tuesday morning before class. Swoon. Adam was convinced that the later we left, the quicker the drive home would be, so we laid in bed all morning watching corny Lifetime Christmas movies and listening to our floor mates leaving for home. I was feeling strangely conflicted, anxious to get back to gossiping in my friends' cozy bedrooms, yet apprehensive about what, if anything, I could contribute to the discussion. I hadn't gone to homecoming, and I didn't have a crush on anyone, and I couldn't remember how to get into my email. What was I going to talk about? I got the same activity books everyone else did, and the one time I ventured out to one of the vaguely interesting events, to the movie club, which turned out to be me and 3 other weirdos watching Pulp Fiction in an empty classroom at night with no snacks, I was disappointed and vowed to never try any new things ever again. Except for that one time John dragged me to a Young Republicans meeting. Oh, and Bible Club. My winter break would consist almost entirely of coffee shop gatherings during which I'd sit silently, listening to the kinds of sugar-coated fables of idyllic college life that I didn't have to offer. Lush, sprawling lawns and picnic lunches on the quad, and sororities chosen and pledged. I hated these get-togethers. First of all, I didn't know how to order coffee. I still goddamn don't, because it is gross and unnecessarily fussy, and I am a grown woman who really cannot tell a cup of bad coffee from a good one. I will drink coffee if it has a pint of cream, 900 packets of real sugar, and comes with a shot of insulin, which is why I don't drink coffee. So I'd be sitting there in the same hoodies and gym shoes I'd worn in high school, feeling like an asshole because I ordered a hot chocolate while everyone else was drinking complicated lattes, bored and mute because the most exciting thing I'd discovered in the months prior was that if I showed my student ID at McDonald's, they would take 10% off my fries. These bitches were at Brown and Harvard and Georgetown, driving their parents' old BMWs to parties around campus, while once a week I waited 2 hours sometimes for the local Sycamore bus to drop me off to buy Pop-Tarts and maxi pads at Walmart. No, I was not going to voluntarily talk about my college experience. So many expectant eyes, peering at me from under so many shiny, blunt-cut bangs. What could I tell these girls that would satisfy their curiosity? That college, at best, had been a lateral move I hadn't really wanted to make? That I really should have learned how to sew in a weave or take apart a carburetor? Because school never really has been my thing, and there is no shame in being an hourly working person? I couldn't tell them that all I did was constantly call my friend Anna in Rhode Island and anxiously wait for her monthly care packages, Portishead's second album, various Sark books, etc. That my very first ATM pin was Matt Schaefer's birthday, even though he was halfway across the country playing rugby at Dartmouth and probably didn't even remember who I was anymore. That's the kind of gross, creepy, weird I am. The your birthday is my pin number weird. In my mind, I poured hot chocolate down the front of the ringleader's silly Fair Isle sweater and bounced the empty paper cup off the top of her head. In real life, I told them about the used record store I hung out in pretending to be Janine Garofalo in Reality Bites. They remained unimpressed. It was a long afternoon. Adam and I were the last ones out of the dorm. Adam hauled the luggage through the hushed, darkened hallways, while John carried what was left of a Budweiser-fueled McDonald's run the week before. A crumpled bag filled with slimy old nuggets and cheeseburgers that he had reheated in the tiny communal kitchen on our floor and cleaned of bits of mold. The three of us slipped and fell across the parking lot toward one of two remaining cars, while sideways winds blew snow directly into our faces. While John wedged his oversized frame horizontally into the back seat, and I struggled to breathe under the weight of what I can only assume were suitcases full of mesh tank tops and Cubs jerseys in the front, Adam uneasily piloted his tiny car through the blizzard and out of the student lot. I shouldn't eat old McDonald's. An hour on the road, and we were still only 10 miles outside of campus. As holiday traffic inched imperceptibly along, John snored peacefully in the back seat, and I squinted at the radio dial and tried to pick up a signal from DeKalb's one decent radio station. Suddenly, I felt something strike a match in the pit of my stomach. I ignored it, continuing to search vainly for strains of that one Third Eye Blind song everybody knows by heart and hates. What I found instead was droning conservative talk radio, artificially cheerful Christmas carols, the play-by-play of some football game being held in the middle of a cornfield, and fuck, there it was again, except this time it was slick, boiling oil churning through my large intestine at breakneck speed. I need a bathroom, I blurted at Adam, my armpits suddenly damp. I need a bathroom right now. Adam threw up his hands, helpless inside his toy car, gesticulating wildly toward the stretch of motionless cars in the icy tundra before us and, I don't know, bleeding like a teenage girl about how far the nearest exit was. I tried to distract myself from the reality that I was trapped in a metal box with two spray-tan pieces of beef jerky by returning my attention to the useless radio in front of me. An eerie calm washed over me as I felt another wave of molten lava break gently against my intestinal wall. I bolted upright. "I am going to shit in your car," I announced, surrendering to the inevitable. John awoke with a grunt, jumping out of the back seat as Adam desperately yanked the car out of traffic and onto the shoulder. I kicked out of my reasonably priced new Walmart winter boots. John snatched my door open, threw the suitcase I was holding into a snowbank with one hand, and held the empty cheeseburger bag out to me with the other. "In here," he commanded. "Okay, sure, bro." Leaning with my right side against the open car and my left arm wrapped around John's leg for balance, I squatted, hopeful and relieved, my eyes trained on the bead of sweat trickling slowly down Adam's temple. When I first moved into the dorm, I didn't shit for 3 days. The morning after move-in, I got up at dawn and eased out of my room in my freshly purchased pajamas into the dimly lit corridor. I had everything the Bed Bath & Beyond ad suggested a young woman headed off to college would need. A large shower caddy with multiple compartments to carry things from my room to whatever shower stall I could claw a bitch's eyes out to get into so I wouldn't be late for biology 101. Bacteria-resistant flip-flops to protect me from other people's periods. And a towel big enough to protect my boobs from the prying eyes of girls who had never seen their mom's grown-up veiny breasts before. I tiptoed into the bathroom, glancing under the stalls for tiny manicured feet. When I saw none, I slipped into the closest stall and waited a few seconds before letting out the loudest, grossest fart any non-zoo animal had ever emitted and taking the biggest shit ever. Like the fattiest, fast foodiest dump any human had ever taken. I emerged from the stall several minutes later, light as air, my butthole singing, and ran smack into a trio of girls responsibly washing their faces over the sink, eyes aghast behind the thin layer of Clinique Mild Cleanser they passed between them. I avoided eye contact in the mirror while washing my hands, then spent the rest of the semester sneakily shitting at 2 p.m. in the crumbling library in the center of campus. Now, I shit all over my jeans, legs, hand, and that greasy, disintegrating bag, as good Christian people in four Tauruses pretended they weren't trying to figure out what was happening on the other side of Adam's car. After the first wave, I kicked out of my jeans entirely, held my butthole closed as tightly as I could against the cold, wet air, and started digging a toilet hole in the snow. "You are a goddamn genius," John boomed proudly next to me, swirling snowflakes getting caught in his beard. I crouched again as another forest fire raced through my guts. Under ordinary circumstances, I would be totally fucking humiliated, demanding that these dudes turn away from the embarrassment of my thighs. But when you are shitting yourself in public, in broad daylight, the last thing you worry about is some drunk kid from Schaumburg seeing how long your pubic hair is. "Atta girl," Coach John shouted encouragingly over the dull roar of the howling winter wind, awkwardly patting the top of my head as I was, once again, clinging miserably to his knees while evacuating my bowels onto the side of the road. "You're doing so good." An odd surge of pride rushed through me. Adam, absolutely horrified, tossed me an NIU t-shirt he'd yanked from his gym bag. I fashioned it into a makeshift washcloth, "Go Huskies," and then used mittenfuls of melting snow to clean out the diarrhea that had splashed into my vagina. John kicked fresh snow into my shithole as Adam hyperventilated inside the car, punching buttons and twisting knobs like a man possessed as he tried valiantly to not look at my shame. The radio finally caught a spark, that bittersweet symphony song that was everywhere in 1997, suddenly crackling out of the tinny speakers. And then the car died. Happy birthday. Thursday, February 12th, 1998, was the day before my 18th birthday. Some girls on our floor had papered the hallway with pink and red construction paper hearts in anticipation of Valentine's Day, and it was a source of constant annoyance to me. No one at NIU wanted to have sex with me, and that was fine, but I didn't need a visual reminder that I was hideous and unloved every time I dragged my poor unclogging face wash to the goddamn bathroom. I had a break after my English class and came back to the dorm to drink imitation Cokes and watch MTV while ignoring the mountain of homework I'd accumulated since the beginning of the semester. The phone on the wall rang as soon as I unlocked the door, and I paused to figure out whether it was for me. Two rings for Kara, one long ring for Sam. Or maybe it was the other way around. The phone was for me. On the other end of the line was a detective from the Evanston Police Department, and I knew, because he was using his gentlest inside voice, two things. One, someone had made sure to tell him that I was 17 years old, and two, my father was probably dead. At this point in the heartrending after-school special of my life, there would be a flashback to the week before, when I'd received another startling and unexpected phone call. But first, a little bit of background. Samuel Bishop Irby was the kind of alcoholic who made grain alcohol in our bathtub and sold what he didn't drink in Sunny D bottles to the local degenerates in his crew. Samuel Bishop Irby was the kind of alcoholic who would drink three bottles of NyQuil if my mother forbade his going to the liquor store and hid his car keys where he was too drunk to think of looking for them. Samuel Bishop Irby was the kind of alcoholic who, when desperate for a fix and home alone with his pre-adolescent daughter and an empty liquor cabinet, would soak a loaf of bread with shoe polish and drink whatever he could filter through the loaf into a glass. SB, as his friends called him, was handsome and charming and affable, and he had the greatest laugh you've ever heard. But SB was also broken, just totally broken, and I couldn't grow up around him. It wasn't safe. After my mom and I moved out when I was four, SB's life underwent a series of changes, most of which I have no real idea about. He'd move away, get his life together, come back, destroy it again. I saw him randomly, in fits and starts, and always on the upswing, always with a healthy glow and toothy grin, singing a new song about how he really was going to get his shit together this time. I'd like to think that eventually he pulled it together for me, that when he'd gotten word I was suffering, some paternal urge deep within him willed him clean and sober and back in town, superhero cape affixed firmly to his collar. The part of me that needs to believe my life was important to a person who created it clings to that, but I am logical, realistic. I know otherwise. At that point, I was worth little more than the $500 or so monthly Social Security check that followed me like a dowry to whoever was willing to take me in. When he caught wind that this money was up for grabs, he was back in town in an instant, back in his chauffeur uniform and cap, buying me a futon and a tiny television set. But SB had his eyes on a bigger prize. The state was paying my mother's nursing home rent to the tune of $900 a month, and my dad figured that if he could somehow get her into his household, that money could be his. "This is not a good idea," I whispered into her ear as my father laid out his plan, fast-talking like a used car salesman as he spread papers of zero consequence, full of calculations that she could barely understand, across the cafeteria table. I glared at him, my chubby fingers laced through her skeletal ones, my eyes shining with tears. She was nodding excitedly. "You need a nurse," I murmured, my heart fracturing, incrementally, as I watched her excitement build. "This house doesn't even have a ramp. How are we going to get your wheelchair inside?" She didn't want to hear me. She had been locked away in this place for 3 years already, waiting to die, and now she could have what she always wanted, her husband and her kid and a home. Together. I tried to hide how much I was crying as two techs and my father loaded her into the car, my father sweating and cursing as he folded her wheelchair and shoved it awkwardly in the trunk. It took half an hour for us to get her inside the house, me tilting her wheelchair backward up the concrete steps as SB grimaced under the weight of her balanced on his shoulder. I read the list of her medications and the instructions that the patient care technician had scribbled on a notepad over and over as she beamed up at me from the couch. As much as I wanted my mom back, this wasn't the way to do it, with no nurse and no real money, and a man with a hair-trigger temper sleeping in the next room. I have to stop and tell you that this is not a place I revisit often in my mind. of everything, of all the sad things and disappointing things and hurtful things, this is the place in my head that it hurts most to go to. This part, where my mom, my baby, has such a monumental insult added to injury. It makes my heart die a little to even think about it. She was so hopeful, man. So happy. Like a kid finally being adopted after having been passed over in the orphanage dozens of previous times. And all we had to offer her was a couch. A television with all the cable channels on it. Diapers she was too humiliated to wear in front of a man who had chosen the bottle over her love. And pills I had to put in applesauce so she could swallow them because she couldn't really swallow anymore. She needed a nurse. She needed a bed that she could raise and lower. She needed a feeding tube. She needed a call button and a daily doctor visit and occupational therapy because she couldn't remember how to use her hands anymore. And for the $900 my father had already gambled away on the lottery, she didn't have any of those things. You also should know that I was 15 when this experiment took place. And lest you start to cast me in some sort of saintly light, I was still wholly consumed with 15-year-old things. Spanish tests and boys and Tori Amos and things. I was anxious and stressed out and, most of all, resentful. Resentful that, as I'd suspected, all of the caretaking would again fall to me. I had played this game before. Years before my mother had even gone into the nursing home, I had done the pretend you can have a real life while inadequately caring for this terminally ill person charade. I felt like my time had already been served, that the payoff was a normal curfew and shoulders that weren't hunched beneath the weight of adult responsibility. Mom would sleep sitting up, bolstered on either side by shapeless pillows, on a couch salvaged from some rich person's trash and from which she was rarely moved. She watched TV, ate her meals, took her medicine, and decomposed a little bit more every day. The three of us were such a goddamn nightmare. When she went back to the nursing home, it came as no surprise to any of us. The ambulance slid away from our rented house with her tucked safely inside, malnourished and fragile, deflated by this most recent disappointment. Her meager belongings bounced in the small suitcase balanced across my knees as SB and I silently followed behind them in the Cadillac, his face grim. Now I stood facing the corner near our dorm room's door, nose almost touching the wall, because I could feel Kara's concerned eyes searching my back for a clue. The phone felt hot and slippery against my ear. "Your father is missing, Samantha," the detective said. "He's been gone for over 24 hours, and no one has any idea where he is." I let silence fill the empty space between us. After 30 seconds, he cleared his throat. "We will be in touch with you as things develop, okay? We're doing everything we can to find him." "Finally," I whispered, "I'm turning 18 tomorrow." "Oh, I'm sorry. Happy birthday." This is a tiny little love story. My mom had three little girls, born when she was 16, 18, and 21. She raised them on her own and was often seen around town with the three of them trailing behind her, all ribbons and bows and shiny patent leather. She was an emergency room nurse who mostly worked nights so that she could be home with her children during the day. SB drove a bus for the now-defunct Evanston Bus Company. My striking mother, 6 feet tall with hair, lips, and talon-length nails all a shocking red, would line up her three little girls a few afternoons a week and wait at the corner of Main and Elmwood for the bus to take them downtown. And wow, oh wow, my parents met on a bus, but here's the thing. Every day the four of them, pretty as a picture, would get on my dad's bus, and every day he would cover the coin slot and refuse to let my mother pay. Fuck, I don't know what's sexy anymore, but it's probably a sign that I am a grown-up for real, that the idea of someone saving my weekly bus money is, like, totally hot. That is romance. So this cat-and-mouse game continued for a while, my dad covering up the fare box, my mom smiling coyly while taking her seat and never speaking to him. Then it took a turn toward next level when my mom decided to repay this charming bus driver's kindness with an invitation to dinner. When I heard this story as a kid, the thought of inviting some strange dude over to my house to eat dinner with my kids made me go, gross, weird. But it was the 1960s, and my mom had three little girls, and driving a bus for a failing suburban bus company was as good a job as any. They dated for 11 years before getting legally married, which, for those of you who don't know any black people, is just the way we do things. I guess it takes a while to know what you really want. Carol, the youngest of my sisters, was 15 by the time I came along to usurp the affections of the only father she'd known, and she expressed her displeasure by immediately trying to suffocate me in my crib. My mom and sisters had been living on the second floor of a duplex where my skinny, mean grandmother fried sardines downstairs, while SB lived in a shag-carpeted bachelor pad across town. As a wedding present, my dad conned the bank out of a loan to buy them a large Victorian in a decent black neighborhood not far from where two of my sisters were finishing high school. There's nothing better than being the product of a late-in-life pregnancy, at least until the shriveling invalids pushing their walkers around your 10th birthday party begin their rapid decline before you even get hair on your privates. But before that, it's all gravy. Before their eventual divorce, I was spoiled and coddled and feted and fed Frosted Flakes in front of the television like King Shit of Fuck Mountain. My sisters had grown up sharing clothes and crammed into one tiny bedroom while my mom slept on the pull-out couch. I, on the other hand, had a room to myself just off the dining room with a desk and a television and a little rug for our collie, Trudy, to sleep on. I had every doll imaginable, every Cabbage Patch and Monchichi and Strawberry Shortcake doll, a toy box stuffed full of Light Brights and Hungry Hungry Hippos and Connect Fours, a little record player on which I listened to Here Come the Smurfs ad nauseam. I was their opportunity to do things right this time. There were no missed parent-teacher conferences, no preschool talent shows left unrecorded. The thing about fucking dirtbags is that no matter how much cologne you splash on them, they're always going to be fucking dirtbags. My father, ever the entrepreneur, decided that it wasn't enough to work all day and pay for this prize of a house. He decided to build rooms, red, erect, shoddily constructed clapboard cubicles, in the basement of our house, red, where his three nubile stepdaughters and tiny infant baby lived, and rent them out to his friends, red winos. So yes, I had the limited edition Strawberry Shortcake doll, whose shiny plastic skin actually smelled like actual strawberries, technology hooray, but I also watched my dad hit a dude in his head with a hammer on our front porch in an argument over a dice game. It was like a seedy men's hotel, except one, illegal, and two, in the basement of our house. Some dude died down there. It never struck me as strange because that is how my life had always been. School bus pulling up to take me to daycare at the YWCA while some junkie was passed out asleep on our front lawn. Normal. Sitting on my dad's lap while he cut up my dinner and spoon-fed it to me despite the fact that I was old enough to use words like tolerate. Also normal, accompanying my father to throw a wrench through the windshield of his mortal enemy's car in the middle of the afternoon. 2 days after I turned 18, there was a card in the mail from my mother. It was a generic birthday card, one I'm sure the nursing home had boxes of tucked away for residents to use. The lettering on the outside of the envelope had been carefully printed, nothing like my mom's usual artsy loops and curls. The inside read, in the same steady hand, "Dear Samantha, I am very proud of you for being at college. It was so nice to see you at Christmas. I can't wait to see you again. Love, Mom." In the bottom right corner, there was a series of unintelligible dots and squiggles. A piece of paper had fluttered to the ground when I opened the card, and I picked it up. It was a note from my mom's hospice nurse, apologizing for the formality and explaining that her condition had deteriorated to the point that she could no longer use a pen without help. Grace is a real nice lady. She is having a lot of trouble speaking lately. I tried to figure out what she wanted me to say as best I could. I hope you have a good birthday. This is a luxury, you know, being spared the day-to-day deterioration of someone you love. I really wish I could have hugged that nurse. My aunt called. My father had had two heart attacks and a stroke, or two strokes and a heart attack. Fuck, these are the kinds of details that blur. I can tell you, with near certainty, that I was wearing an oatmeal-colored knit turtleneck sweater, but not the ratio of heart attacks to strokes my dad had at the end of his life. He'd been living in a halfway house in Memphis since the failed attempt to reconstruct our ailing family. After we put my mother back into the nursing home, I spent my junior year of high school tiptoeing around his rules and his rage with mostly successful results. He slapped me a few times, and once he punched me in the eye. We ate a lot of navy beans on hot water cornbread and vegetable soup made with V8 juice and frozen vegetables because, besides hard-boiled eggs, those were the only things I could cook at the time. It was okay. Somehow I managed to get a really high score on the ACT. His heart had always been bad. Multiple heart attacks and surgeries, that kind of thing. I remember coming home from school one day that winter to find a note that he was going into the hospital, written in his shaky, girlish hand. He said that he hadn't been feeling well and that Dr. Weiss wanted to admit him for observation. I immediately kicked off my snowy boots in the middle of the living room, not allowed, grabbed a bottle of Bailey's from where he'd hidden it, under the sink, and cuddled on the couch under a blanket in front of the television. Definitely not allowed. I called myself in sick the next few days, leaving the house only to walk to the corner store for cans of soup and to play the lottery numbers my dad would leave on the answering machine every afternoon with the money he'd hidden for such emergencies in a shoebox in his closet. I shoveled the sidewalk so no one would suspect anything, but other than that, I watched my so-called life repeats and slept the dreamless sleep of the relieved. When SB finally came home, he did so with a long scar snaking across his chest. "It's called a defibrillator," he said, tapping the tender flesh over his heart as I tried not to vomit. "It sends a little electrical shock through my heart whenever it stops beating." He explained the differences between the exciting new technological advancement that had been installed in his shiny new Franken-chest and the average, run-of-the-mill pacemaker inserted into other septuagenarians. "You see, the pacemaker regulates the heart constantly, but this guy only gives me a little shock when I need it, and that's pretty cool, right?" While proudly brandishing a card that he had to carry with him to keep him out of jail in case he set off a metal detector at court or in an airport. He looked gaunt and skinny, even though he'd been gone only a little over a week and had been on solid food for at least 5 days. My glasses were still taped across the bridge from when he'd broken them with his fist months before, the bones beneath them, though healed, still slightly shifted off track. I remember thinking how big he'd seemed that day as I stood bleeding uncontrollably into the kitchen sink from my broken nose, my vision blurred. "This dude here looked like a guy I could take in a fight." He commented on how clean the house looked, but my stomach churned as he surveyed the room, hoping he wouldn't notice the dust on the piano that I hadn't practiced on even once while he'd been in the hospital. I have never owned a microwave. I've lived on my own since I was 18 years old, and every time I've eaten a Lean Cuisine in my pajamas at 8:30 on a Friday night, I have waited 45 goddamn minutes for that motherfucker to cook in the oven before doing so. Sam Irby had a thing about microwave ovens. "Those silly machines destroy all the nutrients in your food," he would grunt, shuffling away from the freezer case where I stared longingly at all of the Hot Pockets and pizza rolls. "Just get a pack of hot dogs and meet me in the car." My dad resented that no one had ever taught me how to do women's work. He was disgusted that I had spent 15 years on his earth without learning how to buff a linoleum floor to a mirror shine or make a proper casserole. It was beneath him to fold his own boxers. I didn't know shit about keeping a house. I didn't know that mini blinds need to be dusted and rugs dragged out in the yard and beaten clean. No one ever taught me how to defrost a freezer or scrub a dirty oven without setting my hair on fire. My dad wanted a perfect 1950s TV housewife, while all I wanted was a perfect 1980s TV dad. Stephen Keaton never punched his kids over a frying pan, and Philip Drummond never kicked a hole through Arnold's bedroom door because his pants hadn't been perfectly pleated. But I'm a quick study. You have to pile all of the dirty dinner dishes atop my snoring body only one motherfucking time for me to understand never to go to bed without cleaning the kitchen first, no matter how tired I am. Dan Connor was the kind of dad who might let you get away with nuking a can of beefaroni and serving it to him for dinner, but Samuel Bishop Irby wouldn't stand for any of that, especially not with his new mechanical heart. The night he came home, he peered at me over his reading glasses with the ICD user manual balanced on his lap. "No magnets and no microwaves, ever," he said authoritatively, tapping the page. My heart could explode. The afternoon of the detective's call, Kara and I had been studying for a biology test. I had a huge crush on our professor, this swaggering Brit who would roar up to the science building on his Harley Davidson and never took off his leather vest, not once the entire semester, while teaching us about eukaryotes and recombinant DNA. It was a lecture course that took place in this massive auditorium, which meant that we spent most of our afternoons fighting sleep in the nosebleeds while trying to discern scientific terms through a thick English accent. I was listening to Ani DiFranco, of course, on my headphones because Kara didn't like to study with noise, but I couldn't stay the hell awake unless I paired bio-vocabulary with lyrics from Hour Follows Hour. Kara's notes were better than mine, but I was better at drawing and labeling, so we often studied this way, back to back in our opposite desks, trading sheets of graph paper every few minutes. Kara tapped me gently on the shoulder and pointed toward the phone. I snatched my headphones off and ran to pick it up. It was Dr. Weiss. Ira Weiss is an angel. I'm sure there are times he doesn't put the cap back on the toothpaste, or leaves only an inch of orange juice in the carton. But as far as real-life patron saints are concerned, that kind, soft-spoken gentleman was my father's. Dr. Weiss had been SB's cardiologist since the first of many heart attacks in 1984. And my father, ravenous consumer of potted meat and salt pork, dormant volcanic mountain bubbling with an undercurrent of molten rage, enthusiastic guzzler of the corner store's finest $4 champagnes, kept that dude in practice. You know what that asshole was doing when he lectured me about how my desire to enjoy a bag of microwave popcorn was going to cause his heart to burst forth from his chest? Eating a Polish sausage while high on cocaine. 147 arterial blockages, give or take, and my dude would still be like, what is this, lettuce? If I deigned to serve a salad alongside our grilled Spam and Tampico Punch Reduction or whatever slave food we used to eat every night. Dr. Weiss is an Orthodox Jew who keeps kosher and rides a bicycle everywhere he goes. And no matter how many times my father jumped gleefully from the wagon into a waist-deep river of cheap brandy and $2 steaks, Dr. Weiss would take him back, crack open his ribs, and scrape some more corrosion off the rotting meat fist in the center of his chest. The last time I had seen my father was the final day of my junior year of high school, when he moved me into the spare bedroom in the back of my sister Jane's apartment. "Who's gonna fold your sheets?" I called after him as he hobbled down the stairs. "Who's gonna fry your smelts?" He waved at me over his shoulder without looking back and disappeared. A few weeks later at church, I saw his old boss, the man who owned both the house we rented and the limousine SB leased to drive for work. I had never liked James. He laughed too loud and talked too much and dropped by our house unannounced too often. I do not like conspicuous men. And there he was, praising the Lord at the top of his lungs, shaking hands with people as they entered the vestibule. A sickening, oily smile spread across his face as he intercepted me. "Your father stole a lot of money from me before he left town, darling," he growled through a phony smile. "A lot of money," he reiterated, squeezing my shoulder as if a $20 bill was going to shoot out of it. Bile rose in my throat as I pulled away and slunk to a pew in the back of the church. I remembered running across a large plastic bottle, the kind used in an office water cooler, in the basement of the house one afternoon. It was filled with change, mostly quarters and dimes, and sometimes while cowering in the closet as Tropical Storm Samuel roared outside my bedroom, I daydreamed about rolling that thing to the bank and trading that laundry fortune for a train ticket to freedom. Of course he took it, I thought. I imagined him in the rickety Cadillac he'd bought before he left, bouncing down the highway back to Tennessee in a car filled with nickels. Dr. Weiss informed me that after SB had suffered two heart attacks and a stroke, or two strokes and a heart attack, he had spent his own money to send for my father so he could be under his local care. He told me that things weren't looking good and that my father, born in 1933 in Tunica, Mississippi, had survived poverty in the South and war in Korea and alcoholism in suburbia, yet refused to give his body a break for even a minute. He was drinking again and fighting again and not taking his prescribed medications again. I listened to the doctor, his voice soothing and calm, waiting anxiously for him to tell me what was going to happen next. And then my father was on the line, cheerful and gruff. He told me that he was feeling great, that Dr. Weiss had taken him on a skateboard tour of the morgue, and that everything inside was painted in psychedelic colors. It didn't look anything like the cold, refrigerated vaults you see on television. "Samantha, I'm having so much fun." I didn't cry, even though I felt like I should. "My father has gone crazy," I mouthed across the room to Kara as I waited for the doctor to get back on the line. "You rode a skateboard through a room full of dead bodies?" I asked skeptically when Dr. Weiss finally returned to the phone. "Of course we didn't. I'm afraid your father hasn't recovered this time as well as we'd hoped he would." The evening of my birthday, I had gone down to dinner with some guy friends from my floor at 5, but they both had girlfriends, so there was no watching Braveheart on a continuous loop the way we usually spent our Saturday nights. Kara had gone home for the weekend. I had a stack of Jane magazines and a handful of birthday cards that needed responses, but then my sisters called, two of them on one line, and I braced myself for an explosion of off-key birthday singing. SB is dead, Janie said. They found him in someone's yard earlier today. I'm so sorry, Pumpkin. Here are the things that I know. One, my father was placed in a nursing home a couple of days after I spoke to him. Coincidentally, his nursing home was down the street from the one my mother was in. Two, on February 12th, 1998, he decided to go for a walk without a coat.